Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. New research shows that exercise does more than tone and strengthen muscles and bones. It may improve memory. New York Times Well blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote about the study. You can check out the link to her blog at WOSU.org/allsides. Gretchen Reynolds joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
What does the research say about exercise and memory?
It's one more reason that I will go for a run after we have this conversation. It's actually a really interesting study, although it was done in mice. But what it was looking at is how exercise might affect synapses. And synapses are what connect our brain cells. Although memory remains a somewhat mysterious thing, I mean, you know, it's thoughts that somehow are written into our cells. Scientists do know that memories basically reside on multiple brain cells. So in order for that memory to be sturdy, to be prolonged, for it to be stable, the different cells, brain cells, have to connect to one another. They do that through synapses. And synapses can be strong or they can be weak. And if synapses are weak, then the memory is less stable. You're less likely to really remember it. And scientists have known for a while that a lot of things can make synapses weaker, particularly stress. Stress does seem to affect our brain just pervasively. And one thing that it does is it affects memory by reducing the strength of synapses. So the scientists were really interested in whether exercise could sort of counteract some of those effects, could sort of make your synapses strong even if there's stress. So they took mice, because it's much easier to do these experiments with animals, and they had some of the animals experience stress, which they did by basically holding them in place, which makes mice very anxious. They're prey animals. They don't like that. And they had some of the animals run, which mice tend to like a lot. Mm-hmm. And then they had some of the animals experience stress and run. And they used very sophisticated technologies to look inside their brains at their synapses. And what they found was the animals that just experienced stress, their synapses were much weaker. In effect, their memories were affected negatively. The animals that ran had much stronger synapses, so presumably would have much stronger memories. And the animals that ran and felt stress had synapses that were sort of in between. They were not nearly as affected by stress. They weren't quite as strong as in the animals that only ran. But then who, either people or animals, ever gets to just exercise and never feel stress?
Yeah, right.
So that was, it was an attempt to sort of look at real life consequences, which is, people and animals will feel stress, so can exercise sort of counteract that? And they also did find, they looked at some of the animals, they had them learn a maze. And the animals that ran, stressed or not, learned the maze and remembered it much better than the animals that had not run.
That's interesting. Now, how does the length or intensity of the workout factor into this?
Well, again, it's very hard to know because these are mice.
Mm-hmm.
and mice, rather more than we do, seem to like running. And so most of the mice, whether they were stressed or not, they were given access to running wheels and allowed to do whatever they wanted so that they wouldn't feel stressed by being made to run.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them ran the equivalent of about three miles or so over the course of each day. But this is at what for mice is a very moderate sort of jogging kind of pace. They just like to get on wheels and move.
Mm-hmm.
What that means for people is a little hard to translate, but probably getting up and moving, going for a walk, 30 minutes of walking is very likely to have an impact on synapses and improve memory. And it certainly is not going to have negative consequences. And for those of us who feel stress, which certainly is me and probably is everyone out there, it's likely that the stress can have negative consequences on your brain and memory. And it's at least probable, based on this and plenty of other studies, that you can counteract some of those consequences by getting up and going for a walk.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with New York Times Well Blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds. She writes about exercise and wellness. We just were talking about a new study that shows that exercise may improve our memory. Gretchen, you recently wrote about how our beliefs can shape our waistlines based on a recent epidemiological study. Specifically, what do you want me to believe to make my waistline shrink? I'll believe anything you tell me. Sure.
And this is another really interesting study about the mind. In this case, the newest study grew out of a study from a couple of years ago where scientists talked to a group of hotel attendants, room cleaners, basically, who thought that they got no exercise. I mean, they worked all day, so they weren't going out to the gym. The researchers explained to them, you are exercising all day long. All of this work that you're doing as you walk up the stairs, make the beds, all of that, that's exercise. They explained to these attendants that they were actually exceeding the recommendations for physical activity. And a month later, although the people had not actually changed anything in their lives, they weren't exercising more, that people that they had told that they were exercising had lost weight and had better blood pressure and blood sugar control. So just knowing that they were exercising seems to have changed their body's response and health. And that was so interesting that the same researchers decided to do a much bigger study where they gathered records about tens of thousands of people and how much exercise they thought they were getting. Basically, the question was, do you think you're getting as much as, more, or less exercise than most people your age? So it was really asking them to compare themselves to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that whether the people were right or wrong, whether they were actually getting more exercise than other people or not, if they thought they were getting less, they had a much higher risk of early death. And that sounds almost overdramatic, but it was actually a very strong correlation that something about people believing that they're not exercising enough affects the body in ways that really affect our health. And it's not clear exactly what may be going on. It may be that if you think you're not getting as much exercise as your neighbor, you sort of give up and get no exercise.
Or you eat more caramel corn or whatever, because what's the point?
Yeah. Or it may be that it causes stress, and stress hormones certainly can affect the body the brain, as we were just talking about.
Yeah.
But what it also suggests is that it's probably worth, first of all, not comparing yourself to Harry down the street who runs marathons, and look really closely at what you actually do during the day. If you are up and cleaning the house, cooking meals, walking out to get the mail, that is all exercise. Know that physical activity of any kind is good for you, and you are probably getting some already. If you park two slots further away and walk in, that's exercise. So remember that what you do does count. Reframe what you're already doing, and then without regard to what your neighbors are doing, if you can, try and do a little more. Walk a little bit more than you might have. But don't sort of beat yourself up if you don't, because how you feel about the amount of exercise you get does seem to have consequences, even if it's not right.
You wrote about protein and exercise and how there's kind of a relationship between those two things. The more protein you get, the more exercise, the more protein you want. What did you find?
Yeah, well, this is actually a study about protein and strength training, and whether getting more protein sort of increases the effects of strength training, whether it will make you stronger and build more muscle than if you get less protein. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of us think that all these gym rats who are chugging protein shakes afterwards, that that's all silly. But in fact, this study, which was a pretty substantial one that looked at lots of past studies and almost 2,000 people, found that if you do want stronger, slightly larger muscles, there's a really big advantage to getting more protein. And that's especially true for any of us who are over 40. And what the study found in part is that almost everyone over 40 is getting less protein than would be ideal for sort of building strength.
Why? I mean, why are we, you need more and you're just eating? I mean, why is that?
Well, the ideal amount of protein in this study was definitely more than the standard dietary recommendation. Hmm. In fact, it was almost three times as much.
Wow.
So that's pretty substantial. And especially a lot of people, as they get older, seem to eat less protein. At least they did in this study. Hmm. And what the researchers suggest is not that you just add more protein, add more calories, but that potentially you swap out two slices of bread for an extra chicken breast. This was not a huge change, really, in people's diets. It was, the suggestion is, if you want to be strong, if you want healthy muscles, if you are weight training is the most important part. Hmm. Adding more protein allowed people to get about 10% stronger. So it wasn't a huge difference. But for those of us who are going to the gym, which I am now, if you want to really maximize the results of strength training, you probably need to add more protein into your diet. And one interesting thing, any kind of protein was fine.
I was going to ask if it depends on if it's protein powder or if it's a chicken breast. What does it make a difference?
No, absolutely none. And in fact, the scientist I talked to said there is no reason that anyone really has to have protein shakes. Have another chicken breast. In fact, there was also a lot in this study, vegan protein was fine. Protein from peas was fine. Any kind of protein worked just fine. And any time of day, it didn't have to be right after the workout.
Uh-huh.
Just having more protein over the course of the day, which really can be achieved by swapping out some of the other calories you have.
No.
Have eggs in the morning. Okay, just pile
Stop.
It on top. And just, you know, imagine that you're exercising more. You actually ignore all of that.
Yeah. Well, I will try to continue to do all of the above. Gretchen Reynolds, thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds is New York Times Well blog columnist. She recently wrote about a new study that shows that exercise may improve your memory. We'll have a link to all of her blogs on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We used to think that the body is a machine that, if properly maintained, would work how we wanted it to. Then we learned that endurance is all in our heads, that we needed to push through the pain. Now we know that the brain and the rest of the body are linked, not just physically, but in, you know, they really do work together. Outside Magazine science journalist Alex Hutchinson wrote about the limits of human performance in his new book, titled Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So we've gone through this evolution on the topic from thinking our body is just a machine, you know, feed it right, exercise it right, it'll perform right, to just having everything in our heads. It's all about, you know, the psychology of it. Tell us about this shift in thought and how it's occurred.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's speaking of our minds are kind of wired to always want it to be one or the other in any debate and to find the simple answer. And in fact, you know, in many cases, it's a mix of both. So the 20th century was really the high times for the physiology of the body as a machine. We were figuring out all these the ways in which the machine worked, things like VO2 max, which is how much oxygen you can deliver from the air through your heart and lungs to your muscles. But it turned out we weren't able to sort of predict who could win an Olympic medal based on lab tests. And you know, in parallel, there was this stream of sort of positive psychology: if you believe, you can achieve. And so, really, in the last 10 or 15 years, it's when sports scientists and physiologists have tried to kind of bring the two together and try and quantify and understand how the brain fits into human performance.
You talked with many scientists and researchers for your book. Do they agree at this point in time on what's what?
that's a very good question. And it is like, I have to say, it's like a kindergarten food fight. There are strong feelings, personal disagreements, which kind of makes it interesting to follow, but it's all, you know, also challenging to write about, because whatever you write, someone is going to vehemently disagree with you. And it's kind of the nature of science that's in progress. We don't know the answers yet. I don't think anyone would disagree that the brain is important in determining physical limits. But exactly how that happens, why it happens, how we can change it, and of course, who gets credit for some of the intellectual ideas that have gone into this research is really, really hotly contested still, which is kind of part of what makes it fun.
So what do we know about how the brain influences endurance? Is there a chemical thing going on? Is it synapses? What do we know?
Yeah, well, in some senses, we're still struggling for the actual mechanisms. What most people would agree is that there's some evolutionary link that is basically a self-protective link. For, you know, we don't want to be able to push to our absolute, you know, extremes of the limits of the human machine. You know, maybe we had ancestors who could do that, but those were the ones who didn't survive because they pushed themselves beyond their limits. And so we have some pretty strongly wired safety circuitry that through some mechanism holds us back, so that, you know, if I go out for a run and run as fast as I can, the reason I don't go faster isn't because my muscles are totally incapable of continuing. It's that my brain thinks my muscles shouldn't continue. Now, whether that's, you know, one theory is that basically the brain is monitoring the state of my body, and if I'm pushing too hard, it automatically downregulates the signals that it's sending to my muscles. So the brain is always telling the muscles to contract, but so even though I'm trying as hard as I can, the brain signals are getting a little bit weaker and weaker to make sure I don't push harder. Another theory is that it's really all about how hard the exercise feels, that we're wired such that as we push harder and harder, the sensation of exercise gets more and more and more unpleasant, so that we choose to slow down, even though we could. Even if you're in the Olympics and you're in the Olympic marathon, you're in second place, gold medals right there. It's just so unpleasant that you choose to not win because of the sensation of effort. So those are kind of two of the main theories as to how our brain holds us back from the brink.
I was watching the finish on the women's cross country in the Olympics. That was amazing that the U.S. competitor was able to push forward at that 11, you know, at the last minute and make it beyond it. What about goals?
Yeah, no, that finish was absolutely amazing. You know, thrilling to watch, but also kind of a physiological conundrum, because if you think about our traditional understanding of fatigue, it's like you slow down because lactate is rising in your muscles and your heart is going as fast as it can. But well, when they've been skiing for minutes or hours done multiple races, at the end of the race is when you should be most tired and you should be slowing down. But it's kind of a universal phenomenon that people are able to pick it up when the finish line comes into sight, when you know you're going to be able to finish. And so one of the schools of thought is that the fact that people like Jess Diggins can sprint at the end of a race, and in fact, if you go to a local 5K, you'll see everyone's kind of...
Yeah, I've done it. Yeah.
we all do it.
Yeah.
I used to feel guilty about it. I used to feel like, oh, I'm sprinting at the end of the race, and that means I obviously didn't push hard enough earlier. But it turns out that that's what world record holders do too, even on the best day of their lives. And it may sort of signal the fact that early, you know, three quarters of the way through the race, you feel like you're going all out and you can't go any harder and your muscles are holding you back. But then when you see the finish line, all of a sudden you're able to sprint. Well, that's a sign that your brain was kind of holding. It wasn't your muscles holding you back. It was your brain that was preserving some physiological reserve until the finish line was in sight. And then somehow, once you know it's going to end, you're able to kind of tap into that reserve. And so that certainly makes for exciting races at the Olympics, for sure.
We're talking about why we endure the physical feats that we do. My guest is Alex Hutchinson. He's a science journalist for Outside Magazine. He wrote about the limits of human performance in his new book, Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Alex, I think it was in an article that you wrote along these lines, where you noted that that everyone thought you couldn't bust the 4-minute mile until 1954 when someone did, and then last summer, the world's top marathoners, were flirting with the 2-minute mile, which is amazing. Are we that much more physically fit nowadays? Not we, but you know what I mean. Or what does it have to do with when someone breaks a record? What about the rest of us? How does that affect the rest of us?
Yeah, I think there are mental barriers. I should first clarify that last summer, actually, the big thing was the 2-hour marathon.
Yeah.
So we haven't actually got to the 2-minute mile.
I apologize. But, yes.
yeah. But no, it's interesting because these barriers have become big, kind of metaphorical things that we talk about, that once the barrier goes down, it becomes easy. And I think sometimes we tend to get a little too far on, as we were talking about at the beginning, on the it's all in your mind kind of theory that, Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. It didn't become easy. And in fact, it was just earlier this year that the 500th American in history ran a sub-4-minute mile. So there are more billionaires in the U.S. than there have been sub-4-minute milers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, American in history. The physical challenge remains, enormous. But the breaking of the barrier still has significance. It still does kind of open the floodgates to some extent. If someone runs a 2-hour marathon, it's not going to tell me that I can run a 2-hour mm-hmm. marathon. But it's going to tell me that, things that seemed impossible are at one point possible, and that limits are kind of negotiable. And I think that's kind of one of the big messages I took away from the book, is not that it's easy to push through limits or that it's all in my head, but that the limits we experience are never absolute. We in almost no situation, very rare situations, are we actually encountering an ironclad physical limit. If we're encountering limits that feel very difficult to get through, but there's always some negotiability. And so when we see someone break one of these sort of timeless barriers, it's a reminder to all of us that, we're able to keep kind of inching forward and pushing into areas that we didn't think we could get to.
Do genetics, are some people just gifted physically, and does that play a role in any of this?
Yeah, for sure. It's really clear, and if you look at a sport like basketball, right? It's really helpful to be 6'6", and it's easy to see height. So no one would say, "Oh well, height is all in your head." There are traits in almost any sport or in almost any activity that play an important role in success, in elite world class success that are harder to see. They may be naked to they're invisible to the naked eye, but they're there. And so it's never a question of, you know, if you just try hard enough, anyone can do anything. But there are also a lot of traits that elite athletes share that can be developed over time that they're not born with. So one of the interesting areas of research that I looked into was pain tolerance. And, you know, this idea that does the person who wins the race, are they just willing to suffer more? And there's a little bit of truth to that, but it's not that elite athletes are immune to pain. In fact, what the studies find is that, high-level athletes have the same pain threshold as everyone else. So if you start, administering electric shocks to them or something, roughly the same point as everyone else, they'll say, okay, that hurts now. So they feel pain the same as everyone else. But if you keep ramping up the shocks, they'll be willing to tolerate it for longer. They have a higher pain tolerance. And the thinking is that this is mainly just a function of psychological coping strategies that they've developed through the process of training every day. Just the same way that going to work out every day makes their bodies a little bit stronger, their minds are also getting a little stronger. They've developed the ability to distract themselves from the pain or to reframe it as just information rather than a reason to panic. And so that's I think, something that isn't just they're born with. It's something that they acquire through hard work and diligence.
Effort is key here. What can affect our sense or our willingness to exert ourselves?
Yeah, that's a great point. And sort of this idea that it sounds like a semantic thing to say that it's not your muscles hold you back. It's actually your perception of how hard your muscles work that holds you back. It's your feeling of whether your muscles can go harder. But it's important because it means that if you can change how you perceive how hard you're working, this can actually have real physical impact. And so there's some quirky lab demonstrations using things like subliminal messages. They had cyclists cycle to exhaustion, and for some of them they flashed images of a smiling, happy face just for like 16 milliseconds at a time. So they weren't even aware there were images on the wall in front of them. But if there was a happy face, they were able to go 12% longer than if there was a frowning face. So just this sort of having a smile subliminally projected in front of them just altered their perception. There was a sense of ease that permeated their perception of how hard their legs were working. So that's obviously not something that's easy to implement in your daily life. But there are other ways of changing your sense of effort. And one of the most sort of powerful is thinking about your internal monologue and learning to control your self-talk so that you're not telling yourself, this is really hard, you can't do this. And instead, you're telling yourself, you're ready for this, you can do this, keep pushing.
So is it the brain or the body that's more important?
that's the great deep question. I think both matter in every context, but the balance I think depends on the specific context. So if you take a sort of broad sample of the population and say, who's going to be an Olympic athlete or who's going to win the marathon, it's the body that matters more. There's no mental trick that would have made me successful at the Winter Olympics over the last few weeks. But once you start narrowing the field and say, okay, what if we just look at Olympic athletes? Well, they all have these incredible physical attributes, and they all have done the training. And the physical tests we have can't really pick the winners. And there, I think the mind becomes more of a distinguishing factor. And similarly, if I ask myself, what determines if I'm going to have a successful day if I go out and run a race, for example? What's the marker of success or failure? My physical attributes are kind of fixed, but the difference between a good day and a bad day for me, or one that I'm really proud of and one that I'm less satisfied with, is more about the mind and how much I was able to get out of myself that day.
I was listening to some commentary during the Winter Olympics, and they were talking about how amazing it is how many, at least U.S. athletes, dreamed of being in the Olympics at very young ages.
Yeah, I mean,
who does that? I never did.
Well, I'll tell you, I did, and I didn't get there. So I can promise you that dreaming is not a sufficient condition to get you to the Olympics.
Right.
But I think it's a necessary condition. I mean, I think very few people stumble into something like that. That it's a lifelong pursuit of, like I was saying before about the pain tolerance.
Yeah.
I can read the research about pain tolerance and think, I'd like to build my pain tolerance, but I'm not going to go to the gym for 6 months and totally radically re-alter my brain. It's something that it accumulates in steady drips over a long period of time. So I think a lot of these athletes, it's not so much that they learned how to bobsled when they were eight, it's that they started the process of pushing back their limits, of learning to get comfortable being uncomfortable and pursuing a goal over a long period of time. And that process sort of comes to fruition over a very long period of time.
And there are a lot of athletes out there that will pay a lot of money to be coached in this regard. This isn't something you just, you know, they have people who are working with them on that attitude and on what their mind's doing with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone on the Olympic team who didn't do some work with a sports psychologist. And it's one of those things, you know, sports psychology is a relatively recent, I mean, the field's been around for about a century, but it's become more mainstream in the last maybe three decades. And it's become more scientific and really in the last maybe decade, where people are realizing that it's not just kind of a, you know, help me deal with nerves or you know, it's a real quantifiable performance advantage to be able to understand the factors that allow you to push your limits a little harder and to rise to the occasion on the day. So I think, you know, in my own, like I was a competitive runner when I was younger. And if I had one piece of advice for myself, you know, with a time machine, it would be, hey, take the sports psychology aspect seriously and get some help. Don't just assume that you can invent all the solutions yourself.
Alex Hutchinson, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Anne. I appreciate the conversation.
Alex Hutchinson, science journalist for Outside Magazine. He wrote about the limits of human performance in his new book. It's titled Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The suicide rate among whites is 18.5 per 1,000 people. That's the highest total number of suicides for any racial or ethnic group in the United States. But that doesn't tell the whole story. Suicide and mental health isn't just a white person problem. That's according to sociologist Kimia Dennis, who created and coordinates the Criminal Studies Program at Salem College in North Carolina. Professor Dennis recently wrote about the demographics of suicide for The Conversation. You can check out her article at WOSU.org/allsides. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Kimia Dennis.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is it about those numbers that has left suicide to be viewed as a white person problem for so long?
Well, because people are going just based on numbers, and also it's based on a narrow definition of what suicide and suicidal self-harming behaviors mean. So, for instance, what the work that I do, I address demographic and cultural variance when looking at mental health in general and also looking at self-harming behaviors. And so that's why I do the work, including the writing that I did for The Conversation, to get people to go beyond the numbers and to address the fact that this is happening across demographics, and it's happening in different ways than oftentimes assumed.
Is self-harming behavior would be somebody who drinks to excess and then drives and speeds on a roadway on an icy night?
So that would be self-harming behavior, but suicidal self-harming behavior is when people do something with the intent to end up dying, unfortunately. So that's the difference between suicidal self-harm and self-harm itself. So common examples of suicidal self-harm can be when someone goes into a potentially violent environment with the expectation that they will end up dying. And that's a huge, as a criminologist, the work that I do includes harmful environments in which people know that they'll probably die in those environments.
Can you give me an example?
Yes. So the example that I oftentimes provide people is, and this again gets to the demographic variation, mm-hmm. when we talk about opioid addiction, as we all know, the opioid issue did not really become an issue until it was impacting predominantly white environments, and especially when it moved more to the suburban and rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
However, opioid and prescription drug addiction is nothing new. And there are people who use prescription drugs even when they no longer need them, and they intentionally overdose on prescription drugs. That could be related to a number of factors, including people not wanting to feel anything. Not only do they not want to feel pain, but they don't want to feel anything. And that can become suicidal self-harming behavior because they know realistically that the more they take a whole possible container of medication, they might not wake up ever. So that would be an example of suicidal self-harm because it's not the same thing as just cutting oneself, because some people cut themselves as a fetish or cut themselves to reduce pain. But if you're doing this repeatedly with the expectation that you'll die, that's when it becomes suicidal.
You've written extensively about the African-American community as well as others and how suicide and mental health conditions are viewed as taboo and how that mm-hmm. affects the statistics that we are trying to learn from. How so?
Yes. So I do work with mental health organizations and suicide organizations. And we have the numbers, we have the data, but what oftentimes is the problem is that the community outreach is lacking. And so what I do is I speak within African diaspora, Hispanic, American Indian environments, and we talk about the silence and the stigma that happens, what it means when people are told to use their spirituality rather than combining spirituality with actually getting mental health treatment. What it means when people are shamed. So, for example, about a year or so ago, I did a presentation in Ohio where I talked about suicide in African-American Black communities. And one person in the audience said that their family would yell at people, say, if you want to kill yourself, kill yourself. And that's a cultural dynamic in which telling someone to kill themselves is supposed to mean that you're shaming the person to not kill themselves. It's like a reverse logic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's dangerous. As you can imagine, that's very dangerous because although many people think, well, it's working, so we're going to keep doing it, all it takes is one time for that not to work, and then it's too late. So that's why I tell people we have this data, we have the numbers, but what we don't have is the different ways that suicidal self-harm can manifest in people's lives. And cultures and families where people are told to never discuss the topic, and it's oftentimes using religion as well. The
idea just pray your way out of it.
Pray your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're in pain, that means you haven't prayed hard enough. If you're in pain, that means that God is punishing you for not being a loyal servant. And there's all types of ways that people try to rationalize this. And I challenge this when I do community work because I tell people I'm not disrespecting cultures. Instead, I'm saying let's expand our understanding of these cultures. And I also tell organizations that when you do community outreach, you want to know the demographics of your audience. Do annual assessments. Don't think it's mere convenience or coincidence that everyone in the audience is white or heterosexual or middle class. You have to do those assessments to say why is basically everyone in this audience of a powerful demographic. We are not reaching people. That's what it means.
And so a big part of the problem is minority groups failing to seek help. And in certain areas, you're saying they may not be able to get the type of help they need.
Right. So there's different realms. There's failure to seek help, even if there's help available, mm-hmm. because of shaming. There's also most organizations are not trying to make the help available. In other words, thinking about, and I tell organizations this all the time, think about where is your organization located? If it's located in a church, for example, not everyone's going to go to church. Not everyone's a Christian, for example. Also, is your organization within a distance of public transportation? Mm. Is there a bus stop nearby? And also, this is where the cultural consciousness comes in as well.
How so?
Anyone who knows me knows that I'm not a fan of diversity trainings. I feel diversity trainings are a band-aid for a deep issue. Rather than telling people to go to a diversity workshop, I want all medical professionals, all mental health professionals to be required to learn demographics and cultures when they're getting their degrees, certifications, and licenses. Because there's no such thing as health being an objective and culturally neutral topic. It all varies across demographics and cultures. So therefore, let's say a mental health organization is providing support groups and providing licensed counselors. Those support groups and counselors have to be equipped to handle diversity within the group. And what's often the case, though, is that when we tell racial and ethnic minority groups to get help, they oftentimes will come to counselors, go to support groups, go to medical doctors, and the people they go to have no idea about cultural variance.
Mm-hmm.
The people they go to have no idea even how to converse and have a discussion about mental health and suicide and how what that means in and of itself can vary across demographics.
You know, there's a shortage of psychiatrists. I would imagine it's even more acute for the African-American community.
Yes, there's a shortage in African-American communities. And also when we think about this, when you go to cities where there's a small group of African-American professionals, it's also the case sometimes that people want to go to an African-American therapist, mm-hmm. but they know there's a high chance they might actually personally know the person,
huh,
right?
Okay, yeah.
So what does it mean? Right. So on one end, some people want to know the person, but on the other end, some people think that that is kind of dangerous for confidentiality agreements. What it means when you're going to an African-American therapist and that person might be a member of your mosque or a member of your church mm-hmm. or someone you went to school with or something to that sort, some people might like that closeness. Mm-hmm. Other people might feel like, you know, when they go to a therapist, they want to vent about things but not want the vent to be too close to home. So that's another issue that happens in many cities where there's a small group of African-American professionals.
And that's not to suggest that they aren't professionals and they wouldn't.
Right.
But it's a fear, and that's what's keeping people away.
It's a fear.
Yeah.
Right. Because this is the subjectivity of it all, right? This is whether it's, we're not saying that the therapists are telling their business, but mm-hmm. from the consumer standpoint, from the mental health consumer standpoint, that's the most important standpoint that matters. Which is also why many mental health consumers will not go to support group, because as far as they're concerned, they don't know who to trust.
Mm-hmm.
So they might feel like they're going to support group where people are going to judge them, where they're not going to be included, where people are going to gossip about them. And it doesn't mean that's really happening, but that's how people perceive it, which, of course, can justify what they already assumed, which was it's not going to work out.
The number of suicides being misclassification of suicides has been an issue mm-hmm. in minority communities. First, tell us why that is and tell us maybe why that's changing.
So there's not a whole lot of data about misclassification of suicide because we don't have a whole lot of evidence that there's been a change or an improvement in data collection regarding this. But I will say you can go back to about the 1970s and see reports that Black suicide is increasing. And then you'll see in the 2000s reports that Black suicide is increasing. So when you see that fluctuation like that, it really makes people like me wonder, is there really an increase or is there better data collection over time?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's similar to the dark figure that we talk about in criminology, criminal justice. The dark figure refers to crimes in general. because, of course, when we look at the data, it's a report of law enforcement data. And if there are certain crimes that are unreported or they're misclassified by a coroner's report or whatever the case may be, that can result in a dark figure, the difference between the data that's collected and what's really going on. So a similar component can be happening for suicide, for especially groups in which, if it's a gun death, for example, a coroner might misclassify it as a homicide. And depending on where you are across the nation, I don't know this for a fact, but it could be the case that also some families do not want something documented as a suicide.
Hmm.
Or it might be as cause of death uncertain or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because, you know, we're looking at deaths that happen all across the nation, urban environments, suburban and rural environments. And so that's one common concern that we have, because when you look at cause of death data, of course, we all have access to that national data. And it shows, for example, the number one cause of death for Black males ages 15 to 34 is homicide.
Hmm.
And suicide is about number four, further down than that. And so what I ask as a criminologist is, are we certain that these are all homicides, or is it just reported as a gun death and assumed to be a homicide based on the coroner's report? And that's something that, you know, there's not a whole lot of research about that, and that's data that's difficult to find as well.
Pardon me. Sheila in Brunswick, we're running out of time, but I did want to get to you. Welcome to the show, Sheila.
Thank you so much. Hi, I just want to say that I have a 24-year-old son that, from the beginning, he was cognitively and developmentally delayed. He had ADHD, and he was showing signs of depressive disorder. Anyway, my son is 24 years old, and he's currently serving a four-year sentence in Mansfield, which I feel is totally, completely unfair, because his mental health history was not taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And his crime was, you know, attributed to the mitigating circumstances of his mental capacity. He's 24 years chronologically, but mentally and psychologically, he might be dealing with the, you know, capability of a 15-year-old.
Okay.
That.
We're getting short in time, Sheila. Yeah, go ahead.
My son was convicted in the county of Lorain.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That, I believe that criminal justice system is so racially biased. I mean, for the prosecutor to be, Anglo-Saxon, the judge Anglo-Saxon, and my African-American defendant son, I mean, and then he had a court-appointed attorney.
Sheila, I'm really sorry. I do not want to cut you off, Sheila, but we are running out of time.
So can I respond really
absolutely
quickly?
Kimia.
So Sheila, thank you so much for calling in. So one common thing for all people who are incarcerated, most people in the outside world are never diagnosed with their condition, but especially when people are incarcerated, a lot of them are not diagnosed till afterwards. So what I recommend Sheila do, since it's going to be difficult to reverse this criminal justice process,
mm-hmm.
is to contact the prison facility and check and see what kinds of counseling services and medical facilities they have, which includes whether or not they have medicine and prescription drugs to provide them. And also, of course, the attorney can still take part in this to figure out if he can get a lesser sentence if his mental health was a factor.
Kimia Dennis, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimia Dennis is an associate professor of sociology and criminal studies and creator and coordinator of the criminal studies program at Salem College in North Carolina. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.